So I need to begin this sermon with a little bit of a disclaimer, if you will, somewhere between an explanation and an apology, perhaps. As most of you know, the other half of my religious identity is Unitarian Universalism. And while I'm no longer serving congregations in that tradition, I still do quite a bit of supply preaching. And I wrote this sermon originally for a Unitarian Universalist audience. And in that tradition, we approach sermons a little differently. We don't necessarily preach from Scripture. Our text or our inspiration can come from many different places. Sometimes Scripture, sometimes writings from other faith traditions, or poetry, or philosophy, or even an essay in the newspaper. So while this sermon will touch gently on this morning's scriptures, it also draws inspiration from Zen Buddhism, the poetry of William Blake, and an opinion piece by Margaret Renkel, who is a contributing writer for the New York Times. I wouldn't normally take a sermon written for one context and present it in the other. But in fact, the primary text, if you will, for this morning's sermon was a nugget of wisdom from Mary Lou Cummings, something she said during a Soul Talk meeting early last spring. And so when we needed a preacher for this morning, I thought it might be okay to share with you the thoughts that she inspired in me. For anyone here who didn't have the joy of knowing Mary Lou, she was a wise and beloved member of this congregation. And she died last September, on my birthday, in fact. It was not the present I had hoped for. But it was at either our March or our April Soul Talk meeting, I forget which, and we were meeting on Zoom because that was the only way that she and Bob could attend, when Mary Lou mentioned how surprised she was to find that people did not seem reluctant to talk with her about death. In fact, she said people seemed really eager to talk with her about death. Everybody wanted to talk about death. And then she said something that has really stayed with me. She said, when you're talking to people about death, it's really important that you bring all your joy to the conversation. When you're talking to people about death, it's really important that you bring all your joy to the conversation. And that illustration of eating ice cream at Marilyn's funeral is such a beautiful example. I had forgotten that, Ed, and I thank you. Now, I didn't get a chance to ask Mary Lou exactly what she meant by that. She had to leave the Zoom call a little early. And then, as many of you know, there was a long period of time where the combination of concerns about COVID and Mary Lou's increasing weakness meant that we weren't able to visit with her. We couldn't sit and have those conversations that we longed to have. So I had plenty of time to sit by myself with that comment and ponder it in my heart. And it became the heart of these reflections. I got the definite impression when she said that she was finding all those conversations about death a little difficult. Not because she was afraid of death, I don't think she was. And I don't think she was in denial about her own death, and I don't think she was unwilling to talk about death. I got the impression that people approached those conversations so very seriously that they had become afraid to laugh in her presence. And Mary loved to laugh. I don't think she was saying, I don't want to talk about death. I think she was saying, please, let's be fully alive as we talk about death. Let's celebrate life as we talk about death. Don't act as if I'm already dead. Now, it's hard to bring joy to a conversation about death. Whether we're talking about a literal death, our own, or someone that we love, or whether we understand death as a metaphor for anything really devastating, the end of a relationship, the environmental crisis, our divided nation, war and conflict around the world, those are all sort of death conversations. Like the writer of Ecclesiastes, we accept that there is appointed times, there are appointed times for different things. So there's a time to mourn, and there's a time to dance. And in the times of mourning, it may feel either impossible or just really inappropriate to experience joy. But Mary Lou's comment got me thinking about what it might feel like to try harder to bring joy to those times. Can we dance even as we mourn? Because so often it seems to me that pain and joy do come intertwined in our lives. When the war in Ukraine was first unfolding, back in the very early spring, and I realized as I wrote that it's been almost a year now, hard for me to believe. I remember being so moved and so saddened by the stories that were coming out and the pictures in the paper, those devastating photographs of refugees fleeing the country, of children traveling alone, people leaving with their pets strapped to their bodies so that they could carry their few other possessions that they could take, the men who were staying behind to fight, weeping as they said goodbye to their families at the train station. It was so hard to look at those pictures. And yet I felt as though in all of my helplessness, the one thing I could do was to bear witness somehow and not turn away from all that pain. And at the exact same time, we were having the most glorious early spring that I can ever remember. Green was bursting out everywhere, and the bird song would be ringing out from the trees as I read the articles full of images of war and suffering. And I couldn't help feeling joy at all that beauty all around me. And then I felt really guilty to be experiencing all that joy when so many others were knowing nothing but despair. So I talked to my sister about it, which is what I do whenever anything is troubling me, because I'm lucky to have that kind of sister. And she sent me an article from the New York Times by Margaret Renkel. Some of you may know her writing. I think she's really profound. And she wrote in that article about the tension of experiencing the joy and the beauty of the spring, even as we know that the earth is in peril, and that we as humans are largely responsible for that peril, and that so much of the greenery that is lifting her heart is actually the result of invasive species that are doing damage, and that she knows she does not deserve this joy. And yet she writes this: "I refuse to quell this joy. It's possible to understand what invasive species are doing to the woods and still feel the leaping heart of joy in greenness. It's entirely possible to understand what human beings are doing to the woods and to one another in this moment of dread and grief and terrible struggle, and still exult in birdsong and tiny blooming flowers peeking out from the dead leaves of autumn. In this troubled world, it would be a crime to snuff out any flicker of happiness that somehow leaps into life." And then she goes on to say, "We are creatures built for joy. At the very saddest funerals, we can hear a funny story about our lost beloved, and God help us, we laugh. We can stagger out of an appointment where a person in a white coat has given us the news we think we cannot bear to hear, and still we smile at the baby in the checkout line clapping her chubby hands at the balloons by the cash register, or kicking her feet in joy at a stranger's smile. This is who we are, the very best of who we are. We are creatures built for joy," she says. "This is the day that the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it," says the psalmist. He doesn't say we should rejoice when things happen to be going well. We are called every day to rejoice, even in the midst of sorrow and pain. There's a poem by William Blake, and in Unitarian churches we sing these words to a Ralph Vaughan Williams tune that's also "Come My Way, My Truth, My Light." Some of you know that hymn, I think. We use that same beautiful, haunting tune with these words from William Blake. And he writes, "Joy and woe are woven fine, clothing for the soul divine. Under every grief and pine runs a joy with silken twine. And then he goes on to say, it is right, it should be so. We are made for joy and woe. And when this we rightly know, safely through the world we go. Yes, we are creatures built for joy. And we are made for joy and woe. One does not preclude the other. They coexist. But it's hard to live in that reality that joy and woe are woven fine. It's hard to bring our joy to the hard times. Sometimes when I'm in the presence of someone else's pain or suffering, I may be aware of the joy in my own life, but it can feel inappropriate or even disrespectful to acknowledge it. How dare I feel joy when my friend is dying, when the refugees are running from the bombs, when the earth is on fire? And of course, when I'm trapped in my own pain or sorrow, facing my own death, my own grief, my own fear, then it can be very hard to find any joy to bring. And yet our psalm this morning reminded us to be strong and take courage, that we will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living, in this lifetime, that we dwell here and now in the house of the Lord. Even with its sorrow and pain, we're called to rejoice in the goodness that surrounds us. Now, this claiming of joy, even in the midst of death, literal or metaphorical, is woven into stories about the spiritual journey in many religious traditions. And I would like to share one story that is a teaching tale from Zen Buddhism. It may be familiar to some of you. It's known as the story of the tiger and the strawberry. And I will warn you, as I'll quote a commentator in a minute, who says also that most people really hate this story. Once upon a time, as a monk was walking through a forest, he saw a tiger peering out at him from under the underbrush. As the monk turned to run, he heard the tiger spring after him to give chase. Barely ahead of the tiger and running for his life, our hero came to the edge of a steep cliff. Clinging onto a strong vine, the monk climbed over the cliff edge just as the tiger was about to pounce. Hanging over the side of the cliff, with the hungry tiger pacing above him, the monk looked down and was dismayed to see another tiger stalking the ravine far below. Just then, a tiny mouse darted out from a crack in the cliff face and began to gnaw at the vine. At that precise moment, the monk noticed a patch of wild strawberries growing from a clump of earth near where he dangled. Reaching out, he plucked one. It was plump and perfectly ripe, warmed by the sunshine. He popped the strawberry into his mouth. It was perfectly delicious. And that's where the story ends. Now, I found a great commentary on this story by a Pakistani medical doctor and humanitarian named Dr. Munir Kazmir. And he writes, "Now, most of us don't like this story. Indeed, even devout students of Zen Buddhism struggle with this teaching and its meaning. Most particularly in societies influenced by Hollywood, modern tastes generally run more toward the happy ending. We want the mouse to speak. Perhaps offer to save the man in some magical bargain. We want the strawberry to transform the man into a bird who flies away to safety. But most of all, we just can't stand the ending of the tiger and the strawberry. The most burning question is left unanswered, dangling. What happens to the man? Except we already know what happens to the man. Of course we do. He dies." Dr. Kazmir goes on to remind us that we are all, actually, living each moment of our lives in this exact situation, suspended between life and death, that our very existence is absolutely astonishing, and that we should approach each moment of our brief and fragile life with a profound sense of appreciation. And he closes his piece with a quotation from the Buddhist monk Pema Chodron, who some of you may know. I admire her very much. "Tigers above, tigers below. This is actually the predicament that we are always in terms of our birth and death. Each moment is just what it is. It might be the only moment of our life. It might be the only strawberry we'll ever eat. We could get depressed about it, or we could finally appreciate it and delight in the preciousness of every single moment of our life. That monk delighted in the preciousness of even the very last moment of his life. You could say he brought all his joy to that conversation about death. And the strawberry was perfectly delicious. Buddhists don't shy away from talking about death. It's an important part of their tradition. There are whole lengthy meditations designed to lead you through a process of imagining your own death. And they emphasize the importance of living our lives within the context of our coming deaths and still claiming joy in each moment. I think this is harder for Christians to do because we often avoid talking about the reality of death by focusing on the life to come instead. I'm always annoyed when I go to funerals at the way they truck the dirt away and hide it under a grass tarp. The first time I ever did a graveside service, the funeral director asked me if I needed him to provide sand to scatter on the casket when I said earth to earth, ashes to ashes. I was bewildered. Won't there be dirt? I asked. Well, no, there was no dirt at the graveside because that would look too much like death. And most cemeteries require mourners to leave before the casket is lowered into the ground. I asked a funeral director about this, and he said that that's because it can be upsetting to people to see the casket lowered. But isn't that the point? If we're going to a committal service, we're going to commit the body to the earth and to honor the reality of what has happened, to see it to the end. Now, granted, that may or may not be the end, depending on how you understand what comes next, but it is an end of something precious. Jewish funerals are much more honest. Not only is the casket lowered while everyone is still there, but then everyone takes a turn, shoveling a shovel full of dirt onto the casket until the casket is covered and no longer visible. It's understood to be the greatest mitzvah, the greatest blessing that you can do for someone, because you know they can never repay it. While Buddhists insist on confronting the reality of death, it often seems to me that Christianity tries to ignore it, putting the emphasis on the resurrection as an event that has defeated death. I have to admit, having been raised a Unitarian Universalist, the first time I found myself, the joke about Unitarian Universalists is that we are terrible hymn singers because we're always reading a line ahead to see whether or not we agree with the words. So I try really hard not to do that. And when I first started coming here, it was a challenge because my theology is not always, as you know, perfectly in tune with sort of the mainstream of Mennonite theology. But I decided to sing everything with an open heart and see how it spoke to me. And I was so taken aback one of my first Easters to find myself singing, "For Jesus has risen and we shall not die." I thought, what? Surely we don't mean that literally. Okay, maybe we do. I don't mean that literally. Because of course we die, just like the man in the story. He dies. And the people we love die. This past year has brought losses for many of us. I've already spoken of Mary Lou. John and I both lost dear friends to pancreatic cancer this year. I know some of you had deaths in your family and friendship circles that were heartbreaking. We've had a lot of time to mourn. And I suspect that among us, we have a pretty wide range of understandings of what comes after death. And for those who believe in a life to come, that certainly eases the sting of death. But I remember vividly 40 years ago being with my father when he died. And whether or not he went on to another life, he surely was gone from mine. And I mourned. And when I think about my own death and ponder the mystery of what might come next, pondering that mystery doesn't change the fact that the life I know now and cherish here on earth will end. And yet, the night my father died and we mourned, my mother, my sister, and I went out to dinner, And we drank wine. Am I allowed to say that from this pulpit? We did. We drank wine. And we told stories. We remembered my dad. We thought back over the years we'd shared with him, and we laughed. We brought our joy to that conversation. We danced as we mourned. And when I think about how finite my own time here on earth is, I rejoice in the beauty that surrounds me and the love that connects me. And I appreciate it all the more because it is finite. So for me, the message isn't that Jesus conquered death or that we won't die. It's that even in the face of death, joy can still arise. It's not, for me, that the crucifixion is canceled out by the resurrection. The miracle for me is that they can coexist, that the lifting of the spirit, our capacity for joy and renewal and rebirth, is so strong that even death cannot suppress it. Throughout our lives, we face very real pain. This is not one of those Pollyanna sermons that says, oh, just look on the bright side and everything will be fine, because the suffering and the fear and the pain are real. But in the midst of all of that, we are still called to honor and experience joy. And doing that is not a betrayal of those who suffer, and it's not a denial of the hardships of our own lives. It's hard to look for joy when things are at their worst. But staying in touch with the joy is what sustains us through the struggle and gives us the energy to work for everything that is still beautiful and good in our own fragile lives and in this beautiful but broken world that we share. I was finally able to visit with Mary Lou before she died. And we did indeed end up talking about death. But we also relished the beauty of our surroundings and counted the different varieties of butterflies that we saw in the butterfly bush. We relished the beauty and the butterflies and the joy of friendship. We affirmed life, and we laughed a lot. We brought our joy to the conversation. And so may we all, today and every day.